So as we begin our first Taisho or Dharma talk of this week together, a few guidelines and a few points of interest. One, if you're new to our Boundless Way Zen style of listening to a Dharma talk, we listen from within our Zazen, that is within our sitting practice. So words may come to your ears and they may make sense to you or not. You don't have to remember anything. This isn't a sermon or a lecture. Taisho is the Japanese word that means a demonstration of the shout. So sometimes we refrain from shouting and use words instead. And I also want to just check with Jason that you can hear me okay. Yes. All right. So because Boundless Way Zen is so rich in teachers, we have 7 fully transmitted teachers in our community and 3 partially transmitted teachers. And the 3 partially transmitted teachers are here with David Roshi and myself this week. So we 5 together who are here present decided that we're going to offer Taisho this week in partners. And we worked out a way to have different partnerships every day. So you'll hear a Dharma talk from 2 of us. And this morning, I'm going to begin the talk, and Dharma Holder and Reverend Bob Waldinger is going to finish it. And so all the time we're talking, we'll be sitting in our upright posture, receiving whatever it is that Bob and I have to offer. And we also decided together to work on one particular koan this week, although who knows, as the week goes on, maybe we'll change our minds. But anyway, our intention at this moment in time is to investigate together the koan in the Gateless Gate collection of Wu Men, case number 23, which is about a very important moment in the life of our 6th Chinese ancestor, whose name was Wei Neng, who we named today during our ancestor lineage dedication. Wei Neng was a teacher who wrote his own sutra. He wrote a sutra called the Platform Sutra, or some scholars think other people wrote it about him. And it's kind of his biography, if it was written by other people, or autobiography, full of his teachings. And it was written sometime in China, many centuries after the Buddha died. And this is a custom in our Mahayana style to either discover or create our own sutras. And this happened over the many thousands of years since the Buddha lived. So Wei Neng, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about him before Bob takes over and talks about the koan itself. But I want to give you a little background on Wei Neng. He was someone who lived in the 7th century in China. And according to the legend about him, and this whole story, as far as we know, is a legend. It could have happened. Some scholars dispute almost every part of it as a justification for Wei Neng's and his followers' way of teaching Zen. But I myself love stuff that's made up. I actually am of the opinion that pretty much everything human beings do culturally, socially, is made up. And that's especially true in Zen practice. It seems like we have all these right and wrongs, you know, bow this way and put your chopsticks just so and hold the sutra book and et cetera, et cetera. But really, human beings made all that up and transmitted it from person to person. And now what we have is a way of practicing which is full of different forms, ideas, stories that have changed subtly or severely over the 2,600 years since the Buddha was on the earth. So this made-up quality is not a negative thing. It's how human beings learn how to work together as one body. And that's really what we're doing here in our practice of Sesshin. Sesshin sometimes is translated as unifying the heart-mind, and you might almost say that it unifies human beings. We start to resonate together. After a few days, you won't even think about all the different forms. When it's time to bow, you'll bow, and the whole Sangha will bow with you, and in some way, the whole universe will bow with you. So this story about Wei Nung was made up by somebody. As I said, it probably didn't happen this way, but who cares? If you care, then care away. So Wei Nung was also called the sixth ancestor because he was in the sixth generation from Bodhidharma, who also a lot of legends and stories about him. He was an Indian teacher who brought the practice of Zen, or Chan, as it's called in Chinese, to China. And six generations later, we have Wei Nung. And every person who experienced this great way and became a teacher transmitted their heart and mind to at least one successor, sometimes many successors. Up until this point in time, there was a direct transmission from person to person with Wei Nung. But after Wei Nung, the lineage split in many pieces. So part of the Platform Sutra, as I said, is his justification for his line being the best. And don't you think that your way of practicing is the best? Apparently Zen teachers of the past, present, and probably future think that too. So he was famous for being illiterate. He didn't know how to read or write. It's probably true that he did know how to read and write, but in the story, he's the illiterate child of a widow. His father died when he was young, and he made his living and supported his mother by gathering firewood for people. And one day he was in the marketplace and he heard a monk, someone dressed in a yellow robe, chanting from the Heart Sutra. And this may happen to you when you hear the chants of the liturgy. Sometimes there's one line that really penetrates you. In this case, for Hui Nung, it was this line: abiding nowhere, let the heart come forth. This was the line that struck him so deeply that he ran over to that monk and said, tell me about this. What is going on? And the monk explained who his teacher was and explained about Zen. And so Wei Nung then and there decided to leave his mother. He, in one version of the story, which should please us, made arrangements for other people to support her so she wouldn't be abandoned by him. And he went to find this monk's teacher. And the monk lived down in, lived up in the north of China. Hui Nung came from the south. The people from the north thought the people from the south were barbarians. And here was this woodcutter, this seller of wood who was illiterate, who came to meet the teacher at the monastery. And the teacher challenged him and said, people from the south are barbarians. What do you think you can learn from me? And they had a wonderful exchange that's pretty famous. Maybe we'll talk about that later on in the week. But Wei Nung proved himself by saying that people from the north and people from the south were basically the same, and that there's no north or south in the Dharma. So the teacher felt that here was somebody who really was worth cultivating. And so, in the way of Zen, he sent him away to the rice threshing hut, and for 6 months he left him alone to thresh rice. So about 6 months from his arrival, the teacher felt that it was time to name a successor. He probably had Wei Nung in mind, but he announced to the whole Sangha that he was going to have a contest to see who would be the best successor. And at that time, there was a head teacher, kind of like one of our Dharma holders, who everyone respected and thought, he's the guy, he's the one. So nobody else joined in the contest. But this Dharma holder, this person who was respected by the whole Sangha, doubted himself. And he decided to participate in the contest anonymously. And the contest was The teacher said that everyone should write a verse expressing their understanding of the Dharma. So this man, this monk, this Dharma holder, he in secret wrote a verse on a blank wall, a wall that was going to be decorated at some point with paintings, and it had been whitewashed. And so he wrote his verse on the wall, and the verse went something like this. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a clear mirror. Moment by moment, wipe the mirror carefully. Let there be no dust upon it. And when the teacher discovered it, he praised the verse, and he said everyone should memorize it. And somebody read the verse to Wei Nun, the rice threshing monk at this time, and he disagreed with it. He thought it wasn't correct, that there was something about this endless polishing and wiping the mirror clean that didn't jibe with his own experience. So he asked a friend to write a different verse on the same wall, again in secret. And this verse went like this. Bodhi really has no tree. The mirror, too, has no stand. From the beginning, there's nothing at all, so where can the dust alight? And when the teacher saw this verse, he knew that he'd found his Dharma heir, but he took off his slipper and erased it and said everyone should just ignore it. But that night, he invited Wei Nung into his quarters and asked him if the rice had been threshed. And Wei Nung said, yes, it has. And they spent the rest of the night delving into the Diamond Sutra, which is where the verse that had originally touched Wei Nung's heart had come from. And then as the night started to turn into dawn, the teacher said, you are my Dharma heir, and I'm going to give you two gifts that will mark your status in the world. One is this bowl to beg with, and one is a robe to wear to mark this transition. But then he said, everybody in the Sangha is going to be really pissed with you. This is not a literal translation of what he said, but it indicates a sort of feeling in the Sangha that this other guy should have been the Dharma heir, and what was the teacher doing making Kuei Nun the Dharma heir? So the teacher said, take the robe, take the bowl, and get out of here as fast as you can, and keep hidden for some years, and then you can come out later and be a teacher in full. And one of the most touching moments for me in this story is that the old teacher took his Dharma heir down to the river where there was a boat. And the two of them got in the boat, and the old man rowed his Dharma heir across the river, left him off on the other side, and then came back. A beautiful metaphor for how the transmission works. The next day, of course, he announced what had happened, and all the monks got very, very angry, as he predicted, and they all started a chase after Wei Nung. And one monk in particular, who had been in the army before he had ordained, whose name was Ming, was the fastest and strongest of all of the monks, and they all dropped away from the chase, and only Ming was left. And Monk Ming encountered Hui Nung, and this moment of encounter is where the koan begins.
So, that's the end of episode one. We now arrive the next day at episode two, which is the koan that we will explore this week. Wei Nung, neither good nor evil, case 23. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, the fierce general, as far as Tayu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, Ming said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori, great enlightenment. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his vows, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huangmei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." Wei Nung, the teacher, said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huang Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." And then Wu Men, who collects these koans, always makes a comment and he always writes a verse. So here is Wu Men's comment on that story. He says, "It must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He is like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it into your mouth. Then you only need to swallow it down." And now here's Wu Men's verse. "It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed." So much in this story. So much richness. And thankfully, we have a week to play. But right now, where my heart is in this koan is with Ming, fierce head monk, former General Ming, who outruns everybody, all the other monks, dashing after this upstart, who's got this robe and this bowl. He runs as fast as he can after something that he's hoping will bring him what he lacks, what he desires, what he's longed for. This sign, this symbol of attainment. And boy, have I lived that out in my life. Have I been General Ming? And it reminds me of a story when I was 13 years old. Because you probably remember middle school and what a horror that is. And for us then, it was all about being cool. I think the term is different now. But to be cool, the boys needed to wear a certain brand of V-neck burgundy-colored sweater. And I remember just yearning and just thinking, I've got to get this sweater. I've got to. And I went home and I told my parents, and they were like, "Oh, okay." So I got my burgundy V-neck sweater. and I wore it. And for an hour or so, I felt cool. Not long after, the student council president showed up in a V-neck bottle green sweater. And suddenly, it had all changed. That thing that I thought I could get and would make me feel okay had suddenly switched. How many of us long for and run after symbols, that promotion, that trophy partner, that new car, whatever will make us feel like we finally got it, we finally arrived. Maybe that full Dharma transmission. And so we find ourselves longing for and sometimes not getting what we want and living with that pain. Sometimes getting what we want and realizing that it is not nourishing. That sense of emptiness is still there, that sense of lack. And there is Ming saying, I want this robe. Gotta have this robe and this bowl. And then Huineng brings him right back to this moment and says, this robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. Suddenly, a shout. Suddenly, a slap. Suddenly, just this. Just a robe. Just a sweater. And he says, take it. And Ming tries to lift it up, and of course, he can't lift it. He can't lift it because suddenly he knows that this is not what he yearns for. This is not what will nourish him. How many of us came to Sesshin with these secret hopes? Maybe I'll settle into deep samadhi. Maybe I'll get great kensho. Maybe my chattering mind will just leave me alone for a few moments. Passing koans, bowing the correct ways, putting the spoon in the correct direction. So many ways to try to do it right and feel okay. And none of it compares to what Huineng held out for Ming like a kindly grandmother. Ming got it. He said, I came for the Dharma, not for this symbol. And I beg you, open the way for me. So the teacher invites him in the way that we invite each other. Huineng says, don't think good, don't think evil. And he's not just talking about good and evil. He's talking about all the slicing and dicing we do. Don't think has and has not. Don't think good enough, not good enough. At this very moment, what's right here? What's your original face? What's just this? And of course, Ming has great enlightenment, as happens in these wonderful stories. But he says to Huineng, these secret words and these secret meanings that you've just given me, come on, is there anything else? And of course, the teacher, being the kindly grandmother, realizes that Ming doesn't quite get it yet. And so Huineng says, what I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you. And Ming understands. He says, I'm like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is warm or cold. And we have the chance to know personally what the foot feels like as it touches the floor in Kinhin. What the heartbeat sounds like. How the birds call to us right here, not separate. All right here, hidden in plain sight. And so Ming says, "Lay brother, you are now my teacher." And of course, the kindly grandmother Hui Neng teaches again. He says, "Let us both call Huang Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." And so we invite each other. Let us all, lay brothers and sisters, sample this nourishing Dharma, the Dharma of fans and air on the skin and knee pain, knowing for ourselves hot and cold, bright and dark. And how do we guard this realization that we come to over and over again? We do exactly what Hui Neng did. With empty hands, we give it all away. Thank you.
So please make yourselves comfortable. And people who are sitting behind the fireplace, if you want to move your seats into the middle row between you and the other folks, just to have a better view. And we're going to have our Dharma dialogue now. And during the Dharma dialogue, this is an opportunity for you to participate fully with your own wholeheartedness. Anything that's true for you that comes up as a question, a comment. We're not aiming for intellectual understanding here, but heart-body understanding. And all five of us who are up here in our brown and yellow robes will do our best to meet you where you are. So just raising your hand if you have a question or a comment. And it doesn't even have to be about the talk that Bob and I just gave.
I was identifying with Ming as well. Clearly, his reaction to is driving him to clearly to me anyway. his driving motivation for chasing after was, "Hey, this isn't the way the world's supposed to work. I'm going to make sure it works the way it's supposed to work." Especially being a general.
Nice.
But there was, obviously, he had a kernel of doubt even before, you know, the fact that he didn't sign the verse. And so I'm just grateful.
Yeah.
It's clearly, yeah. Right, so he thought this is the way the world's supposed to work, but he had a kernel of doubt. You know, he wasn't...
Actually, just in, we're talking about two different guys here. So the Dharma holder was a different person, the guy who wrote the verse.
Ming was
he's called the head monk in the story, but he's not the guy who wrote the verse.
Oh.
Yeah. But anyway, I think I'm identifying with what you're saying, because he must have had a kernel of doubt to be practicing Zen, to leave the army.
Right.
And shave his head, disrobe. Right. So you're on track with him.
Right. So I guess my point was, where I was going with that is, like, I was really appreciating that doubt.
Yeah.
Mm. Santa Mato to break out of that. To me, that's his moment of awakening there before him, where he realizes he can't pick up the rope.
Yeah.
And that must have sprung from somewhere. You know.
Can people in the back hear okay? Yeah. If you ever can't hear, raise your hand like you would if you want a little more food, with your thumb and your forefinger up, and we'll do our best to elevate our speaking.
Or we'll bring you food. I don't
know. Yeah, right. Could be what it, well, the servers might get activated, so be careful.
You know, Mike, one of the things I wanted to say, too, is that we can imagine in this story that, well, Wei Nung no longer has doubt. He's got it. But I am certain that Wei Nung, too, that we all live with this doubt. We all move in and out of knowing the truth of just this, and then, oh, maybe I don't have it. Maybe this isn't it. And so the iconic nature of the story, I don't want it to mislead us into thinking that Wei Nung's now got it and he's all set.
Not good or bad.
No.
Yeah.
I was just struck by the line about the discussion of Wei Nung coming from the south to the north and being part of the despised group. So I was thinking, Wei Nung being a Roma, or then I thought a Mexican taking somebody else's job. Mm. Literally.
Yeah.
That would be the attitude of the people.
Yeah.
The mind making good and bad.
Yeah.
Republican, Democrat, we're all guilty of it.
Uh-huh.
Okay. They all do it. And that's, to come back to that place of sort of uncertainty that we value in the practice, I really like the naming of how when he can't pick up the robe, that's not a bad thing. That's actually his moment of success, although he may not see it that way. His saying, actually, wow, I actually don't understand. I can't carry this robe off because I don't get the Dharma. And just to open up and acknowledge that, the vulnerability that's required in that, and that's exactly the gap that allows the Dharma to enter in. So this, this deep valuing within the koan of not being quite so sure that we get it in some way, and that we know what's good and what's bad with any kind of, that it's objectively true.
Julie, I wanted to really deeply appreciate your bringing this story from so long ago to show the relevance in the 21st century, that this way these human minds work hasn't changed in a long, long, long time. And I think actually one of the reasons it resonated so strongly with me is because you pointed to our nature as human beings, not just a particular person who does that, right? It's the species thing that we can do. When, as Mike, I love the phrase you used of the world isn't going, it's not going the way I think it should. Which I experience a lot. And sometimes it's easy to think that these stories are about some people from long ago who have nothing to do with me and nothing to do with my life. And you snapped it right into focus, Julie, into right now, right here. And how can we meet this? How can we turn toward what's happening? And show up in the world. What do we do? And thank you so much for pointing.
Kevin?
I was wondering if you could expand on the fact that Ming, it says in the story, he has great satori, and then the next thing he says needs correction. It's happened a couple of times, and so...
Can I just give an example? I'm sitting here doing Orioki for maybe the 30th session. Melissa leans over and corrects my form. I think the teaching is, it's never done, that there is no place to finally arrive, right? There's no realization that is finally so complete that we never we always escape the slicing and dicing, the mind of right and wrong, the delusive certainty. We're always prone to it. We always fall back into it. And then we can remind each other, oh yeah, just this.
And I think, too, that Ming's great resource is his stubbornness. Right? It's not his intelligence. It's not his creativity. It's not his great spiritual insight. But he was a dogged, stubborn son of a gun. And that's what led him all the way up the mountain, all the way to this encounter. And he is not going to change just by having Satori. And his never enough spirit is still his great resource and still his great problem. And how wonderful that he's not satisfied. You know, how wonderful that he doesn't say, oh great, I get it, I'm cool. You know, he really embodies that part for all of us, that I hope you're never satisfied, right? Because wherever we are is just head through the doorway. So, still a problem, but in some other way, he's just simply manifesting his great awakened nature of delusion.
Yeah.
And, you know, that head through the doorway image is something that Dogen used to describe what happens after awakening. And it's really important to remember that we have our whole life. Once something that we might call awakening occurs and is affirmed by a teacher, because you can't really affirm it yourself because we're all so deluded, and we all have ideas about what awakening is supposed to be like, so we think, I got it. This is it. Now I passed a koan, or you know, the sunlight really touched me, and blah. So I think many of us have had moments like this. This putting your head through the gate is it's just the beginning, Dogen says. And really it is. At that moment, things shift, and that really happened for Ming in the story, and that's why we keep telling the story. And what you're pointing out, Kevin, is just so important, because it's pervasive that people think they're done. I'm done. You know, I got the yellow robe. I'm cool. You know, I'm never again going to make a mistake or say anything stupid or do anything that hurts somebody. If I feel like that, that's a problem. So this constant being willing to learn and to see what's on the other side of the gate until the very last breath, that's to me what the Zen path is. No markers. And so if you came here with some idea, like Bob was saying, of I'm going to get Kensho or whatever that, or I'm going to have samadhi, you know, good for you. And I hope that happens, and then you get to poke your head through the gate and go, oh, that isn't what I thought was going to happen.
Oh, so, we'll get to you. I was struck by the speck of dust thing that sort of made the head monk decide that this other guy really had it together, and the original guy just isn't going to get it. It's going to be this other guy who anonymously wrote about, oh, what speck of dust are you talking about? You know. But now, after the discussion, now I'm seeing the value of the speck of dust. It's exactly what you guys are talking about, right?
Yeah. So the first guy who actually ended up being a Dharma heir of that teacher and starting his own line, which Wei Nun competed with, it his teaching was oriented towards the speck of dust. And it's really an important part of Zen training, that we sit, we cultivate ourselves, we really do that. Right? So the speck of dust is important. And you notice that the teacher in the story, I love this little detail. This is how you know it's a folk story. How could this be a piece of history? He takes off his slipper and erases Wei Nun's verse. Because the relative quality of practice is really important. And people can read, Wei Nun's verse was an emptiness verse. Right? It was about, there's no dust, everything's the dark, blah, blah. And people could say, oh, I know what that means. Yep, nothing matters.
Oh, right, right.
And that could be really dangerous.
Yeah. Right.
So if it's emptiness only, without if it's an idea of emptiness without an actual experience of it, great harm gets caused. So I love that little moment when the teacher goes, oops, maybe most of the people in the Sangha here are not going to be able to go for the, there's no mirror, there's no stand, let's go back to the other one. Yeah, and so they're both important.
Yeah.
They're both important. Got it. And we saw somebody's hand in the back.
Yeah.
That was me.
Good.
I was trying to remember your introductory words when you were talking about kind of the heart is connected to the Dharma. Do you remember what you said?
No, but it doesn't matter. What do you remember?
So,
that's more important.
So because as I hear the discussion and reflecting on what I thought I heard in your words, both of your words, I was just struck that, to me, the heart is part of understanding this Dharma and understanding this emptiness. And so when I was listening to you, I felt very emotional. I just could feel the truly disopening to this not knowing in a heartfelt way. So I just want to share that or your thoughts about it.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
It's not just understanding it intellectually. And I think Ming is kind of cool because he shows how wholeheartedly he went, I really, you know, why did you get it and I didn't? But that wholeheartedness, it is such a physical way to me.
Yeah.
But I took from what you presented this morning.
But, and I think you're picking up on the, as Melissa said when she started, the important thing is not following the line of reasoning of what is being said in the Taisho. Because in some ways the words are just to placeholder, and the Taisho is really heart to heart. The shout is the shout of the great heart of the universe, right? And we can be touched by this. And we cannot be touched by it. But that is the level. There's something going on here in these talks, in this story, in what we're doing that is incomprehensible, inexpressible, and so precious. Yeah, so thank you.
Yes.
So I was appreciating the fact that it's not just Ming who gets his head through the gate and then immediately needs more instruction. That's like a repetition of what's already happened to Wei Nam, because he hears these lines from the Diamond Sutra and has this, you know, gets his head through the gate, but he says, you know, I gotta go where people are talking about this. And, you know, I need a teacher, and I need a sangha. So I love that. And I also love about this koan that, you know, he's addressed that specifically as lay brother. That you know, here we are trying to we love our priests, but we're basically a lay group, and this is our lineage, you know, and it's so easy to forget after all the years of monastic, or the centuries of monastic practice, and it's so easy to think of Zen as this intellectual thing because of the way it became popular in America among artists and writers, but you know, here's the illiterate guy whose practice is polishing rice, you know, and I just want to express my deep appreciation for this koan and for this lineage.
It is just chance that the five of us are all ordained sitting up here, because some of the other teachers in Boundless Way Zen are lay teachers. And we always have a priest of the day who comes down with us, and we only have one other priest here who's Ray, and so he's going to come down every day with that shakujo. So it's kind of wonderful. This particular sesshin is heavily loaded towards the lay, even though it might appear, just because there's five ordained teachers here, that it goes the other way. So definitely nice to point it out.
No, and Ellen, I love that you're pointing out this dichotomy, right, between priest and layperson, and we talked about dust and no dust, heart and head, and I think what David is talking about is that this practice and these stories invite us to go beyond, the slicing and dicing, the this versus that. And yet our minds keep doing it. We keep talking with each other about, well, wait, is there dust or not? What's really important? And so we're always grappling with this and at the same time trying to tune into the music flowing underneath in all these stories and in all this dialogue.
And just one little thing to add there. All the priests in Boundless Way are not monastics. We're, in fact, at least all married. Some of us have children. Most of us have had, well, all of us have had careers somewhere. So that's a shift, too. We're kind of blending lay and ordained in a brand new way. That's very confusing for other Zen teachers, by the way. Our friends who are Zen teachers go, what are you doing?
I thank you for the talk. I really appreciated it. And I really appreciated the phrasing that you used, Bob, around nourishing and nourishment. This has been coming up for me in my life recently, and I think it's a really interesting angle to take on this work that we're doing here of what's nourishing for us, what's nourishing for the world, what's nourishing, as part of our practice, and also, I guess, as our practice. I don't know. Just struck me nicely.
Did anyone want
to? Actually, just could I follow up just for a second? So, what's nourishing for you?
This is pretty nourishing.
Yeah. And what? Can you just say a little more about what? About where does it touch you, or what?
I think for me, when something feels really deeply nourishing, it feels like there's different ways of hitting to the same spot. So for me personally, like being out in nature, or playing music, or creating, or being here with everyone, doing these types of practices, it feels like it's refreshing, like a real deep part of me that needs constant bathing. And I think for me, I've been trying to find more ways to get misted with that in my life outside of Sashin's, because for me in Sashin, it's like, oh, get to jump back in the ocean and swim around, and then gotta crawl up on dry land. We live in that amphibious space in between.
Great, thank you.
And I just want to make sure I can't see anybody around the corner. Has there been anybody who's had their hand up? Mark has. Okay. Go ahead.
So I like this interesting dichotomy with Ming, where he's really bringing forth a lot of effort to get this dharma, or get, find this true kind of dharma. But when he tries to lift the bowl and the robes, he can't do it. So even putting in all of your effort, you can't really attain this dharma. But if you don't even put in the effort, you're not going to reach your original face. So it's a beautiful story.
It's really great to point that out. This particular paradox at the heart of our practice, because we have to get here and do this practice, right? But we can't do it. We were talking about this the other night after a Dharma talk. This doing, not doing, that's so much a part of our practice. What does that even mean? And you can really feel it physically in that moment when Ming's trying to lift, and he just can't. But he's putting all his effort into it.
I feel like this is a really important aspect of practice to me, is clarifying something about intention that is quite a koan, ongoing practice question. There's the teaching that we're already it, and of course Dogen's great question, if we're already it, why do I have to practice? Why don't I just see this? So to acknowledge the importance of intention and practice, using the fan. And at the same time, that we don't actually do it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It reminds me of one of Kate Sensei's teachings, one of the other guiding teachers, and we were talking about these strategies. We all have these strategies. Okay, I'm going to do the retreat on the third day. I'm going to really work hard, probably stay up late. And I was saying at one point, so just whatever strategy you have, just stop. And Kate said, no, no, whatever strategy you have, really go even harder. Go all in until, because you can't put it down, right? Right? But you will get to the place where it will put you down.
Yes.
That's the lucky moment.
That's the lucky. And let's have one more, Libby.
If it's okay, I'd like to go back to the dust, because I'm...
The dust.
The dust has been... worrying me. So there's so much in this story about dust and polishing in various manifestations. So I forgot his name.
Huinan.
He's put to polishing rice. Yes. That means to taking the dust off. He must have been breathing it all these months and the rice.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
And seeing through the dust. And there's also a way in which when you write on a white wall, what you're doing is writing with dust. The ink is merely wet dust. And so... when the abbot or the head teacher erases his verse with his slipper, he's nearly polished off the from the blank wall, which is also another way to talk about a mirror. And I'm just so sort of caught up with this because also we're talking about secrets. So one thing that happens when you write away the writing on the wall is to make it secret. And when Ming chases up the mountain, he wants the secret. And he says there is no secret. Essentially, he just throws up a pan of dust in the air. The dust. That's it. Right there, but it's not it. What I want you to do is look through it, but it's not secret.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got stuck right there. Now what do we do with the dust? No dust. Secret. No secret.
Oh, that's beautiful, Libby. And that's where practice comes in.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to solve that problem by conventional means, trying to figure it out. But as we say, sitting with it, you've created and illuminated something for all of us about this koan, which is why we have these Dharma dialogues. Thank you. And it's a real, like, I don't get it kind of moment. Don't try to get it. But I hate to say this. When the dust settles, something's going to be revealed. And it won't be anything you expect. And it might not happen in sitting meditation or walking meditation or even during this retreat. It could happen, you know, when you're driving away or when you get back home. It doesn't make any, there's no timeline on this. The idea is, we were just saying this, you can't do it, but the effort involved is to keep that resonating for you as long as it has heart in it, to go back to what you said. It is, and then when it stops having heart in it, don't chase after it. Something else will come that's more important. So we're going to come back to our sitting posture. The teachers will leave, and then the jiki will ring the bell twice to signal the beginning of kinhin.